yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a-screaming now. Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, the topic of the show today is U.S. economic potholes. What are the soft signs in the U.S. economy? And are they emerging and growing? We've heard a lot about the growth surge here in the U.S. economy. A lot of talk about post-Trump. We're going to get a recovery here. Well, we're waiting and waiting, and no recovery yet. We had a very soft first quarter, 2/10 of 1% GDP growth, but they're all saying, they meaning the media, the press, the administration, the politicos, that, it's coming, it's coming. Well, the latest data in the second quarter, not that strong. Looks like a little blip here in April, but weakening at the end of April. We'll see when the data comes in a couple of weeks for May what's actually happening. But this growth is not going to materialize to the degree that they're all predicting. And then what will the response be? Well, we saw kind of a nervous hiccup here in the stock market this week, a big drop in the stock market. Well, was it simply because of the political events of the past week, Trump, and of course the firing of Comey and all the fallout of that, as the traditional elites continue their attack on Trump? Keep the pot boiling here. Who knows what may turn up? And New York Times, Washington Post, so on and so forth, you know, that old traditional elite that's nervous about him shaking the tree and about his continual false steps and big mouth and all that that means. Okay, so will it recover? Will we get the growth? You know, Trump is saying my program is going to get us a 3, maybe 3.5% GDP growth. Well, what's been the GDP in the U.S. economy on historic average here since the 2008-09 crash? About 60% of normal, the GDP growth rate, 1.8%, 1.9%, and some say a little bit more, 2%, 2.1%. Well, as I've said many times, you got to take at least 0.3% away from that because of the redefinitions of GDP that went on under Obama. It's not really growing at that particular rate. So 1.7%, 1.8% is pretty much the average here for the last 8 years. It's been 8 years since the crash. Yes, and 60% subnormal growth rate in GDP. And that has produced a whole set of problems, including discontent in certain sections of the country intensified. We saw that result in the last election. Right. Okay, so will we get to 3 or 3.5% that Trump is promising? Well, the stock market is not so sure anymore. And we got that big hiccup. And we'll probably see more hiccups here in the coming weeks. Particularly if the Trump agenda does not move very fast. I would give it until the August recess. If it looks like the August congressional recess this year has not produced significant results here in terms of the tax cuts and deregulation and infrastructure spending, then watch the stock market adjust here in September. And you will see business spending make a big adjustment as well. You know, that's really what Trump is betting on, that he can boost investment, business spending, which has been historically very laggard over the last 8 years. Got a little bit of a recovery here, despite the low GDP, which was offset, however, by other negatives, particularly consumption, consumer spending, household spending. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But Trump is betting on a big boost in gross investment. You know, if you look at GDP, there's really four elements, you know, a little bit of economics 101 here, four elements. One is investment, and the other is consumption, household consumption. A third element is government spending, and a fourth element is what they call net exports, which is trade, in other words, the difference between imports and exports. To what extent does that boost the economy? Imports, a rise in imports reduces GDP. A rise in exports, all things equal, increases GDP. So we got four areas, and to ask the question, you know, will the economy go to 3.5% as we're told by Trump, or will it not? You have to look at these four sectors of the economy: business investment, household consumption, exports, imports, and government spending. Well, Trump is relying heavily on business investment. He's assuming that you cut corporate taxes and investors' taxes, and he's proposed to reduce those corporate tax rates from 35% to 15% in his little preliminary preview that he released on his budget and taxes earlier in the year. By the way, next week we will see more details. On the 23rd of May, they will release the full budget. And we'll talk about that full budget, pick it apart next week. But he's presuming that cutting corporate taxes and business investor taxes is going to stimulate investment. Oh, you reduce corporate costs. Okay, the argument is, in traditional economic theory, which is really bogus, the argument is reducing business costs will automatically result and an increase in investment. Notice business has more disposable income to invest, and it will invest it. It won't sit on it. It won't divert it to offshore markets. It won't reroute it into financial assets markets like stocks and bonds and derivatives and so forth, right? It will actually turn that additional savings that it has, businesses will turn it into creating jobs and creating, building goods and services. Now, that's a big assumption because there isn't much evidence that it empirically is correct. They've been selling that economic snake oil to us for decades now, since Ronald Reagan. And if you look at the correlations between business tax cuts and GDP growth in real investment, it just doesn't exist. Cutting taxes doesn't boost investment. And if it doesn't boost investment, it doesn't boost productivity. And that's a problem in the U.S. economy as well. As we've talked in recent weeks, productivity is flat on its back. It's not going anywhere. And if productivity doesn't rise, the businesses take it out on workers' wages and compensation, and that's what's going on too. Okay, so the assumption is cut taxes and increase investment. Well, that will depend heavily on whether they get the tax cut proposals of Mr. Trump, really are Paul Ryan's radical conservative pro-wealth tax cuts in another name, the Trump tax cuts. Whether they get those through or not, or it looks like they're going to get them through by the August recess. I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think they're going to be anywhere near being able to pass the major tax cuts. By the way, Trump is proposing somewhere between $2 and $6 trillion in those business tax cuts. I don't think it's going to happen. Well, we will see. We will see, of course. The wild card here is all the political opposition to Trump. You see, the traditional elites, especially a certain wing of them, aligned with the media and Democratic Party and the state bureaucracy, in federal bureaucracy, are really pushing back on Trump. They smell blood. They are thinking Trump and Nixon, Watergate, right? And they see an opportunity there. Well, I don't think they're going to be able to impeach Trump. The Republicans will not abandon him until they get the, what they want with these proposals. Of course, you know, he could really pull a dumb move, and that could happen. But I don't think it's likely until after the 2018 midterm elections. The Republicans will not abandon him, no matter what he does. Well, there could be some really extreme stuff come out about investments in Russia and so forth. We never know, but we'll see. But you know, right now they're thinking, well, you know, this guy Pence looks like a Gerald Ford, the substitute for Nixon Trump here. Let's push this idea. We'll see what happens. But the point is that political instability is growing in the U.S. and elsewhere, by the way, in the world, and that is impacting economic confidence, state of confidence by businesses, you see. On the one hand, they're expecting these tax cuts, and that's good for business confidence, for investment. They're going to have more money in their pocket, right? Whether they really invested or not is another question, as I said. But business confidence rises when you propose these big tax cuts. And deregulation, by the way, has the same effect. Reduces business costs, puts more money in their pocket. And whether they actually invest it in the U.S. is another question. But that raises business confidence. On the other hand, what reduces business confidence is all this political instability. Because if the instability grows, then it means that, well, Congress and the system may be preoccupied with political instability, constitutional issues, and they won't be able to pass the tax cuts and the deregulation that will put money in their pocket. Well, we saw the reaction to that, the initial reaction to that in the stock market this past week. Big drop when all the news about the Comey and all of that erupted. Well, we're going to see more of that. And whether we see repeated bouts of that between now and August will have something to do with what happens, with the stock market and also with what happens in Congress in passing these tax cuts and deregulation. The other legislative item that may boost business spending, tax cuts being one, deregulation being the other element is infrastructure spending. Trump has promised $1 trillion in infrastructure spending, but there's no evidence of that at all. Maybe we'll see some of that next week in terms of what he's talking about, but there's no evidence so far. It's just an idea, which shows you, creating jobs by infrastructure is low on the priority list of these guys. High at the top is the tax cuts and deregulation. All right, so that's business confidence and business spending, sometimes called gross private domestic investment, which got a little bit bump in anticipations, high-risk companies that jump out there early thinking it's going to happen. But there's been no real move towards really boosting business spending here. The rest of the economy, i.e. household consumption, government spending, and so forth, is treading water, pretty much. Households' income, is rising, but only at the very top 10% of the households. The rest is really lagging. The rest of the folks' household income-driven consumption is really determined by wage gains and job gains. Lots of talk about the jobs being created, but they're low-paid, low paid, no benefit service kind of jobs. It looks like that job picture is about to weaken significantly here. We saw some evidence last month where the previous average of 200,000 jobs a month was really weakening. And it would be interesting to see what happens with the May and June job numbers here. I think they're going to weaken significantly, and that will have a big impact on business confidence and expectations of where the economy is going. Why? Why will they weaken? Well, autos, as I've been saying, the auto industry is definitely turning down. It peaked last year, and it looked like it churned for a while. But now it's really in retreat. Ford Motor just announced 1,400 layoffs. That's just the beginning. GM has, General Motors has indicated, is pulling out of some global markets. They are beginning to batten down the hatches in the auto industry, and we're going to see a consolidation there and a lack of growth there. The other problem spot is retail. Department stores here are in trouble, and they are contracting across the board. They'll be shutting down stores, and I mean even businesses like Macy's and so forth. We're going to see a lot of retail jobs disappear. Now, most of those are contingent jobs, part-time temp jobs, right? But still, we're going to see them disappear. And by the way, a lot of the layoffs in these contingent jobs are reflected in the numbers for what's called the U6 unemployment rate. U6 unemployment rate records not only the full-time unemployment, that's the one you see reported at 4.5%, but when you put in part-time and temp jobs, the real unemployment rate is around 8.5-9% in the U.S. And they've been saying, well, you know, it was as high as 10-17% during the worst part of the 2008-09 event. But, you know, now the part-time temp contingent jobs are declining in absolute terms, and that's an indication of good growth in the economy, assuming that the part-time is becoming full-time. Well, no, it's just that the part-time contingent jobs are disappearing in retail and elsewhere. Another warning spot is healthcare, which has been a big job growth sector here for the last 8 years. But if this Obamacare goes through, you're going to see a major slowdown, stagnation, maybe even contraction in healthcare job creation. So, you know, autos, manufacturing, healthcare, retail, and so forth, all could impact jobs, the job creation, and therefore household incomes, and therefore consumption contribution to GDP this summer in the U.S. economy. So, you know, soft spots, watch auto, watch healthcare, watch retail, and their contribution to wage growth and job growth. Now, wages, apart from the job boost to wages, are just not growing. Real wages are flat, real wages. In other words, after you adjust for inflation, what is the growth in real wages? Well, hourly workers, that's the median, a lot of median labor force people are hourly employed, about 100 million hourly employed, grew 2.5%, you know, and they're going, whoa, that's a good growth, growth rate, yeah. Well, 2.4% of that is inflation. It's not real. There's no real growth in wages going on. Right? There's nominal growth, but there's nominal inflation. And in fact, inflation for many households is far more than the 2.4%. That's an average for the entire economy. But folks who are, you know, paying for education costs and who are renting and who are buying Obamacare, Trump care, whatever you want to call it now, medical insurance, their prices are going up far, far faster. And in fact, with this little, all this talk and this little growth of, you know, business investment, a lot of companies are now taking, trying to jump on the bandwagon of price hikes and are raising prices. And of course, cities and utilities are doing the same. So you got a lot of price increases being thrown into the system right now that probably won't hold. But for the interim here, it means a reduction in real income and real spending. The average hourly wage increase per year since 2010 has only been 0.5% a year. In other words, it's been stagnant. There's been no wage growth. And consumption, therefore, has struggled. Consumption is 2/3, 70% of the economy. It's the big factor here for whether we get this 3.5%. You know, that consumption is going to have to grow at 4 to 5% in order to get for the rest of this year, in order to get a GDP of 3.5%. And if GDP comes in at 1% or less in the second quarter, that means you're going to have to get this incredible, impossible 5% GDP growth rate in the second half of this year. That's not going to happen. So all this talk is just happy talk, 3.5% GDP. It's not going to happen. All right, and I predict you're probably going to have somewhere between 1 and 1.7% annual GDP for the U.S. economy in 2017. Now, even the 2.5% growth in hourly wages in the U.S., you know, is really driven by gains in median income, but median income is not growing. Because of the 2.5% nominal, not real growth in wages. It was growing because of an increase in the hours worked. So it's workers working more hours, not getting any wage increases. Right? That's been sort of holding up consumption in recent years. Well, if you get a slowdown in the economy, and if you get the loss of jobs in autos, healthcare, and retail, then what you're going to see is a reduction in the number of hours worked. So that propped consumption and income is just not there. We have this chronic problem of labor force participation, 4% decline since 2007-08 in the labor force participation rate, 4%, you know, from 63%, from 67% before, 67% of the workforce were employed. We're in the workforce, the eligible workforce, 67% were employed. Well, now only 63%, actually 62.9%, are employed. So there's 4% somewhere dropped out. They don't count those in the unemployment rate, by the way. But 4% of 157 million labor force, you're talking about 6 million people who just dropped out. Well, they're saying, well, you got baby boomers retiring. Well, that doesn't account for 6 million people dropping out of the labor force or not entering. No. So that's a problem. That's a problem as well. But I want to talk about another problem. You see, if wages are not growing and jobs are going to start leaking and weakening here, and real wages are not growing, then you're not going to get a growth to consumption. And you're not going to get it because most of the consumption growth, except for the highest 10% of the workforce, has been debt-driven. Debt, in other words, borrowing in order to maintain standard of living since 2008. There was a recent report just come out by the New York Federal Reserve. And this report, you know, that periodically they release a report on household debt. Well, household debt today is higher than it was in 2008 when the crash occurred. $12.73 trillion in household debt compared to 2008, which is $12.68 trillion in household debt. Well, yeah, the household, the composition has changed. Much of the 2008 household debt was in mortgage debt. We know the subprime mortgage boom and bust was heavily responsible for that $12.6 trillion debt. Well, you've got $12.73 trillion now in household debt, and it's not concentrated that much in mortgages, but it is concentrated in student debt, now over $1.3 trillion with default rates of over 10% and rising. You've got over $1 trillion in auto debt. A lot of that auto debt has been securitized, meaning banks and dealers sell it off, just like they did with subprime mortgages. You've got credit card debt now over $1 trillion. You have 200,000 households every quarter either filing for bankruptcy or defaulting on their debt. 200,000 households every quarter defaulting. All right. So you've got maybe $4 trillion in student, auto, credit card, installment debt. You're going to get a lot more people now filing medical debt as Trump Care comes online. $4 trillion. Now, for that $4 trillion is about the value of the subprime mortgages that collapsed, $4 trillion. All right, so the amount is the same. The composition is different, but the amount is the same. And I believe that the student auto credit card debt is much more volatile. In other words, you get a downturn, a weakening of the economy. There's not much way you can extend auto debt, right, and renegotiate auto debt, and the government will not do anything about changing student debt. And credit cards, the banks can write off credit cards, but, there's $4 trillion in household debt replacing the $4 trillion in subprime mortgage debt. So we're kind of back where we were in 2008. Very fragile, very fragile. And what we've got now is a incredible increase in parallel of corporate debt. Corporations have taken advantage of the Federal Reserve's super low, almost zero interest rates for eight years, and have issued corporate bonds and corporate commercial paper, and use that because it's very low cost to them, right? The cost is the interest they have to pay whoever buys their bonds and their paper, right? But it being so low, corporations have kind of running their companies, many of them, by issuing this debt. Their profits and their revenues have not been all that great for many of them, but they keep themselves going by borrowing. Okay, so what's the data on corporate debt here? Well, it's $8.5 trillion, which is more than double of what it was in 2008, more than double. So households are up over where they were with debt that started in 2008. You know, they're right back where they were. And corporations are even worse off. And now it's not just banks. It's all non-financial corporations. Corporations have, issued trillions of dollars in junk bond debt, investment grade debt, over the last 6-7 years. Massive debt increase. And by the way, this is a global trend. It's even worse. The private debt, corporate debt escalation has been even greater in emerging markets. South America and so forth, and China. We'll talk about that that kind of debt increase. We got this massive debt overhang here, and should it appear as if the Trump trade will not be realized, in other words, will not be delivered, the tax cuts and the deregulation and the infrastructure spending will not be delivered, should that become apparent, you'll see a quick retreat. Or if the economy becomes soft again, a lot of these corporations aren't going to be able to pay the principal and interest on all this debt that they've taken on. The IMF recently reported that 22% of U.S. corporations are vulnerable because of their debt load to any increase in interest rates. You know, what often precipitates a financial crash is the central bank moves to raise interest rates, and it does so too quickly or too high. Well, that's what happened, of course, in 2006. You know, that's typically what happens. You get an economy that's overinflated and that's growing too much, and inflation is coming, and the central bank raises rates to slow it down. Well, it not only slows it down, it brings it down. That's why I believe that the Federal Reserve is not going to raise rates very much further. You may see another rate increase in June. The Fed would like to raise rates, but the Fed can't. You see, the central bank can't. Its ability to influence the economy through changing the money supply and affecting short-term rates in the U.S. Has been declining dramatically. The central banks are losing control of the money supply and their ability to influence domestic economic conditions. My next book coming out next month in June, which we'll start talking about on the show, is called Central Bankers at the End of Their Rope, Monetary Policy and the Next Depression. This is a thorough look at central banking. You know, central banking is really a relatively modern phenomenon, believe it or not. You know, at the turn of the 20th century, there were only 18 central banks in the world. And really, the modern central banking period begins in the late 1970s. And my book is a thorough analysis of the U.S. Fed from its early histories, you know, 1913, the Fed was created, and even going back even before that to the U.S. Constitution and the period and the growth of the first and second U.S. banks and why they were repealed, and looking at the 19th century and why central banking did not exist in the U.S. and the consequences of that. And then, of course, 1913, the formation of the bank, and what looks like a really poor history of performance, if you look at the U.S. Central Bank. You know, they pump it up and they make it look pretty good, and the academics, you know, all jump in and try to make their careers by saying, oh, the central bank, it plays such an important role. But, you know, we really need to look at this whole thing of the central bank. You need some sort of agency that controls the money supply, but the central banks and the Fed was created by the banks themselves, you see. When the central bank was created in 1913, just a little history here, the U.S. central bank was run by the banks themselves. All the bankers were the directors and governors, and they had these 12 districts, and the bankers formed all the committees in these 12 federal districts of the Federal Reserve. It was run by the banks, for the banks, you see. Well, how do you explain that? Well, you know, when you have financial crashes that lead to depressions, somebody's got to bail them out. And by 1907, the U.S. economy got so big that the banks couldn't bail themselves out. And every time there was a financial crash, you know, in the 19th century, it led to depressions. And in the 20th century, you cannot allow depressions because people are population are too active, and what you get is political crises, and, you know, in severe cases, you get Hitlers and so forth. You know, in the 20th century, they have to stop depressions, and depressions are precipitated by banking crashes, you see. And in 1907, we had a big financial crash, and the bankers couldn't bail themselves out. So the U.S. Treasury had to bail them out. Now, when the Treasury bails them out, the politicals, your elected representatives, get blamed for bailing out the banks. The banks caused the crisis, and then the government saves them. Well, who saves us? Nobody saves us. We didn't cause the crisis. The bankers did. We pay the price. No one bails us out. But you guys, our elected representatives, go and bail the banks out. You know, what gives here? Well, that's why they create central banks. They create the central banks to take the heat off of the politicians. People don't understand how central banks really work and what their functions are. You know, the number one function, purpose of central banks is to bail out the banking system whenever it implodes. And periodically, it always does and will implode. That's endogenous. That's inherent within the capitalist banking system. It will always get out of whack and contract significantly. Well, each time it does, if banks contract, then it brings down the rest of the economy. All right, so someone has to, lender of last resort, it's called, bail out the banks. And that's what the central bank is designed to do. And if the bankers control the central bank, well, that means the bankers are bailing themselves out, and the politicians like it because they aren't at the center of the causal, people believing, pointing the finger at them, oh, you're bailing out the banks, right, not us. So the central bank is kind of a useful entity here to bail out the banks and prevent the politicians from being blamed for the bailout. Oh, how do they bail out the banks? Well, they just print money, you see, because the government has a monopoly on the currency and on money creation. So that's what they do through the central bank. That's the primary purpose of the central bank. As I point out in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, you can go read some preliminary information about what's involved in the book by going to Amazon. It's on Amazon. It'll be released in June. Or go to the publisher and get more information, Clarity Press. Just Google Clarity Press, and you can get more information about it there. Okay. The book covers not just the history of central banking in the U.S., even before the Fed was created, but after the Fed, right up through Greenspan's debacle and Bernanke and now Yellen, the U.S. Fed. But it also covers other major central banks and their history and assessment of their performance. The Bank of England, the Bank of Japan, and the European Central Bank, and even the People's Bank of China. These are the five banks that I look at in this particular study, right, on the performance of the central bank. And the main theme is it hasn't performed very well. It's performed to bail out the banks, but it hasn't done much, in terms of other performances and other functions very well. And, of course, when it bails out the banks, the private banking system, it's been very costly, and the cost is then shifted to the rest of the rest of the economy and households and government and so forth. Right? The big run up in U.S. government debt is really attributable to the 2008-09 crash. Total government debt was $4 trillion in 2000. Federal debt, rather, and then when George Bush left office, it was like $8 trillion, right, from $4 trillion to $8 trillion, doubled under Bush's term in office. But then we've added over $10 trillion to the national debt since Obama. Well, a lot of that directly, indirectly, is attributed to the 2008-09 crash. The Federal Reserve takes on $4.5 trillion on its balance sheet to bail out the banks. The government spends trillions of dollars. I'm talking about the executive and the legislatures spends trillions of dollars to bail out non-bank businesses with massive tax cuts of, $5 trillion here under Obama, actually closer to $6 trillion under Obama. And then the very weak recovery means you have losses of tax revenue by the government, which also raises the deficit and increases the debt. So, at least two-thirds, three-fourths of the increase in the government debt here since Obama came in office in 2009 is attributable to, directly or indirectly, to the crisis, to the collapse, 2008-9. The rest has to do with war spending in the Middle East. You know, we spent like $4 or $5 trillion in the Middle East, wars since 2001 with no results and no end at the no light at the end of that tunnel. $4 or $5 trillion, at least $4 or $5 trillion, and then the other big budget buster is healthcare costs, escalating double-digit healthcare costs, pharmaceutical products, so forth. And trying to deal with that, the government, not doing anything about controlling prices and the price gouging by all sectors of the health industry. And then, of course, the government has to pay for it with Medicaid, with Medicare, and, Obamacare now, and so forth. That's raised the deficit and the debt. So three big problems, runaway healthcare costs, war spending, with that tax increases, and slow growth of the economy, only, two-thirds of normal growth and revenue losses. And then on top of that, $5-6 trillion in tax cuts. Well, that's the $10 trillion in the government debt that we've seen since 2008. That's the whole picture there. It's not rocket science to figure this out, why we have such huge government debt. But, as I said, to get back to it, now we've got not just this government debt grown, $10 trillion since 2008, we've got a doubling of corporate debt to over $8.5 trillion, and we're right back where we were with household debt at $12.7 trillion. So, you have this huge debt overhang on the economy that is a major, major drag on the economy. If I'm in debt, I don't spend as much. You see, I have to pay the interest and principal on that debt. Therefore, the payment of that interest detracts from my ability to spend somewhere else that would boost the economy. And that's true for households and corporations and the government. It's this massive debt overhang that's keeping everything from really growing at normal rates that the economy used to grow. Now, let's clarify something about debt, whether it's a household debt, corporate debt, or government debt. And that is, it's not just the level of debt that's important. So far, I've been talking about the level of debt here. You know, there are a lot of books out there, Graeber and others talk about the history of debt, as if just the rise in the debt level, the absolute debt level, was the problem. That's not the only problem. As I argued at great length in my 2016 book, Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, last year, it's the relationship between your ability to pay the principal and interest on the debt that's important. Not just the level of debt, but can you, quote, service that debt, i.e. pay the principal and interest? Well, being able to service the debt is really about income growth. If I have rising income, I can take on rising debt without a problem. It's the relationship between income and debt levels and the rate of change of income and rate of change of debt levels that is key. And there's another element here that plays a role, and that is, what are the terms and conditions of the repayment of that debt? Terms and conditions. In other words, what's the interest rate? Is the interest rate variable? Is it going to change and rise? How long do I have to pay off that debt? What's the term and the term structure of that debt? And what are all the other terms and conditions involved with that debt? If I default or approach default, will the banks let me roll it over and refinance it? Can I refinance it at a lower rate? Et cetera, et cetera. A lot of banking rules and regulations that play an important role in the ability to service the debt as well. So we got three variables here. You know, we got debt levels, we have income levels to pay the principal and interest, and we've got terms and conditions. Whether debt creates a crisis has something to do with all three of those terms and conditions, not just the absolute level of the debt. This was an idea that was in part developed by a somewhat obscure economist called Hyman Minsky decades ago, you know, and he called it financial instability hypothesis. In other words, over time, endogenously, within the capitalist system, even during good times, you find this growing financial fragility. Fragility meaning the growing inability of your income to service your level of debt, right? If your debt grows much higher than your ability to service it to pay the principal and interest, in other words, you're growing more fragile. If the debt does not grow an accelerating pace, but your income declines, as what typically happens in recessions, then your fragility also rises because you don't have the ability to service the debt levels. And then there are terms and conditions. During boom times, lenders provide easy terms and conditions, but when times, contract, the economy contracts, then they tighten up the terms and conditions. And that plays a role as well. You know, financial fragility. Fragility meaning the estimate of the inability to make payments on debt that have built up over the good times, over the boom times. And debt always rises over the boom times. Businesses, you know, have expectations of continued growth that may not be there, and they keep borrowing. Or they may be businesses that are in trouble and they have to keep borrowing and rolling over their debt in order to pay the principal and interest on the previous debt, right, or other conditions similar. So, you know, the debt level rises over the good times, over the boom times. And it looks like, well, these are great times, you know, and households keep borrowing more and more and businesses issue more bonds and borrow more from banks, and the government spends, and the debt level rises. Well, when you have a recession and you have a turndown of the economy, what happens is income declines. The ability of income to pay for the debt declines. Well, what happens when your income declines? You can't pay the interest or principal or both on your existing level of debt. You see, the debt does not decline. It is always there, and it keeps rising, and you have to make payments on it. But far more volatile is your level of income that determines whether you can make payments on that ever-rising volume of debt. And when you have a turndown, what happens? Businesses' income, their cash flow declines. They can't sell as much products. You know, the demand for their goods and services declines, so their revenue declines. And they may have to start lowering their prices to maintain their market share. And that means their revenue declines. Revenue declines means, they don't have the cash flow in order to maintain the principal and interest payments on their debt. So what do? They may fail to make the interest payments, but just continue to make the principal payments. Or they may fail to do both. At that point, the bank can either let them go bankrupt, default on their debt payments, or the bank can decide, all right, we'll just extend your payments, or we'll give you a moratorium on your payments for 90 days or something like that. But it's up to the banks, you see. Now, when the banks are in trouble with a financial crash, they don't do any of this. They don't give business, non-bank businesses, any breaks. And so those non-bank businesses default. Well, when they default, even before, you get mass layoffs, right? They've let most of their labor force go, which means you have thousands and thousands of households without any income at all. And that, in turn, exacerbates household debt. Households have built up, like corporations, massive debt over the boom period, and they can't pay now because they're unemployed or they got wage cuts. They can't maintain their cash flow, called disposable income. So what do households do? Well, they default. They default. If we have another recession, and we're already 8 years into this even weak recovery since 2008, average is 6 to 7 years for a business cycle. So we're getting on the cusp at the end of this cycle, and you can see it with the downturn in autos and retail, right? But if we have a recession, what's going to happen is that $1.3 trillion in student debt and $1 trillion plus in auto debt and in credit card debt, households are going to stop paying. You're going to have defaults, right? And when you have the defaults, those companies that they were paying to or should have paid to are going to be in trouble. So contagion spreads from the business side to the household side and back from the household side to the business side. Debt is an entity that doesn't go away. Doesn't go away. It has to be repaid, but your ability to repay it does fluctuate wildly. And when you have a recession, the fluctuation is down, and that means you can't pay. And when people start defaulting on auto and student loans and credit cards, and businesses start defaulting on their junk bonds and so forth, it creates a psychological impression. General psychological impression in the economy that everyone starts pulling back. You see, businesses start pulling back from investment. Households start, who haven't defaulted on anything, start watching what they spend and pull in their consumption horns, right? And you have consumption declines even further, and business investment that declines even further. Right? And this is what we're going to see here, I believe, in 2018. I don't believe that they're going to pass the tax cuts and deregulation and infrastructure spending and the time frame are at the level of magnitude that they've been talking. And that's going to create a change in confidence levels, both consumer and business confidence levels. I also firmly believe that you're not going to get jobs coming back, certainly not this year, and I don't think they're going to come back very much at all. This Trump, hype about, oh, we're going to bring jobs back, it's just that, right? They're going to tweak the free trade deals. They're not going to bring these jobs back. There's no way they can force these companies to change. Do you think if Ford Motor is laying off 1,400 people in the United States that they're going to bring jobs back from Mexico? No, it's not going to happen, right? And they're just starting to renegotiate. 90 days that came out, they're going to renegotiate NAFTA. They're not going to change NAFTA. They're going to tweak it to the benefit of businesses and not to the workforce. So the jobs aren't going to come back, and therefore consumption is not going to come back. Jobs are going to weaken, in fact, because, as I said, autos and retreat, healthcare and retail are going to weaken the job numbers. Wages are already flat at real wages, only 0.1% annual growth rate. That inflation effect for education, rents, medical insurance, and so forth is going to reduce real wages even more. exports, you know, the U.S. dollar is not going to significantly decline to boost U.S. exports long term, because the Fed is going to keep trying to raise interest rates, and even if it does so only weekly, that you know, the dollar is going to continue to rise here, and that means higher cost U.S. exports and lower U.S. exports and production of exports. Right, so don't look for any boost to the U.S. economy from net exports. Don't look for any boost from job creation or wage increases. Yes, you'll get more household debt as a way to finance consumption. And as far as business investment, you know, it all depends on the timing and how much all these cost cuts and infrastructure spending promises actually become real. But I don't see anything major this year happening there. And now next week we're going to see the government role in the economy growth rate here. We're going to see even more defense spending and cuts in social programs. Right? It's an offset kind of a thing. He's going to move, Ryan and the Republicans and Trump are going to move money out of social programs. You know, they're going to massively cut Medicaid and food stamps and so forth, move money out of that in education, and put it in defense. Now, that's going to result in a net decline in jobs and spending. Why? Because defense spending is does not provide a boost to the economy the way it did 50 years ago. You know, and plus, a lot of this defense spending on equipment is really parceled out by the U.S., by the Pentagon, to allies. Right? We don't build, you know, an entire aircraft. You know, we give a piece of it to Japan to build, and another piece of Europe to build, and so forth. If you know, in exchange for buying so many of the new airplanes, right? Plus, you know, you spend millions and millions of dollars, $20, $30, $50 million per plane, and you don't get that many built at that cost. So, defense spending doesn't generate the jobs, period. And the social spending does. And if you're going to move the money from social spending to defense spending, you're going to end up with net job reduction and net income reduction for households. So don't look for government spending to really boost, unless we get a really robust infrastructure bill and spending. But you're not going to see that because the tax cuts are coming first. The corporate investor tax cuts, and that's going to really debilitate the U.S. budget deficit. And by the time they get to infrastructure spending, this Republican Congress will not want to spend much, if anything, on infrastructure spending, which would exacerbate the budget deficit, you see. So my analysis is that we're not going to see much in the business investment here. It's going to be by the delay, nor consumption, nor net exports, nor government spending. It's going to slip. When it does, the economy is going to weaken dramatically. All right, that's my assessment of where we are today with the U.S. economy. Next week, we will look at the budget proposal of Trump.